This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with number 87870. 164 countries worldwide. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today. We do a 10th episode show. Every 10 shows, we go off topic. We talk about something of general interest. And today we're going to talk about a lot of stuff about general interest. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about real estate, because everything comes back to real estate investing and income property investing in the most historically proven asset class in the entire world. We've got a returning guest here today, one of our clients, and that is Mr. Andrew Baker. Drew, welcome. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on the show. You were on the show a few years ago. You talked a little bit about your young life, starting investing in income properties in your mid-20s, really, I guess, or late 20s. And now you're married and you got a kid. You got Scotty and your wife, Katie. And we've been friends for, I don't know, about 10, 12 years now, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's been just great to watch you grow and develop and accumulate more properties over the years. And you've got 10 properties now. And you've got, I think, Memphis, Indianapolis, and then your own home in the Socialist Republic of California. Is that correct?
Sadly, yes. I have a house in California. So, but, you know, we're in a nice area. So we live in Orange, right near the Circle, in an old, like, historic community. And I think it's one of the oldest cities in Orange County. So, yeah, it's really nice here, but, you know, it just seems like more people are moving in than are moving out. So it's nice that the neighborhood kind of is getting revitalized, but at the same time, it's getting a little crowded. So, you know, it's funny how many people are moving out of state though. Just in Orange, we've had half a dozen friends move to Texas. So it's kind of funny. Yeah. Farewell today for someone who's moving to Texas.
As I've often said, if Texas were to secede from the Union, it would become the Hong Kong of the United States. In other words, as Hong Kong is to China, Texas would be to the U.S. That's my metaphor on that. You know, of course, the freer the marketplace, the less government intrusion, the healthier the economy, and really the healthier society in general. And we're going to play a little clip from none other than Mr. Mark Stein today. He's a quite famous New York Times bestselling author, radio and TV personality, Mr. Sarcasm. I love his sarcasm, but he's a truly intellectual guy. Love him or hate him. Pretty controversial. He puts stuff out there that, you know, some people won't like. He talks a lot about this free market stuff. And what I love about his work is, I have my disagreements with him too, of course, is his counterintuitive way of looking at things. You know, most people just kind of, and this is interesting, you know, I've read a lot of books about this and heard, you know, experts talk about this, how the brain is a cognitive miser. Our brain is the biggest energy suck in our body. Okay. So our brain tries to be lazy on purpose. It tries to conserve energy and not think too much, because thinking actually takes a lot of power, a lot of energy. And I've heard the stats comparing, you know, how much wattage, if you will, our brain uses compared to the other organs in our bodies. And the brain is that processor takes a lot of power. It takes a lot of juice to juice your brain. And if you don't believe this, whenever you've been engaged in a lot of thinking in a day or in a lot of perceiving, and the one example I think is a good one, at least for me, that I think everybody can relate to, because other intellectual endeavors are maybe harder. And this is not exactly an quote intellectual endeavor unquote, but I'm going to put it out there, it's the shopping mall. So the reason the shopping mall, at least for me, tires me out is because my brain is just being stimulated with overload. So many things to look at, so many things to perceive. What's the price of this? What's the price of that? There's so many people. There's all these products, signs, colors, you know, just wow. And it just tires me out when I go to the mall.
You won't have to worry about that because most of the malls now are going to be closing.
That's a good
retail
point.
Retail Armageddon.
The retail apocalypse, as it's been called. And I think there is a potential U.S. apocalypse. I think there is certainly a European apocalypse going on. Just got back from Europe 2 days ago and spent a day in New York. And now I'm back, thankfully, in Las Vegas. And yeah, it's pretty interesting. But the thing I want to point out about that brain being a cognitive miser, my point is, and Drew, I think you'll agree with me here, is that most people, I mean, all of us to a degree, we want to conserve our brain power. So we don't try to think too hard a lot of times. And, you know, that's what I love about a person like Mark Stein, because he really digs, you know, I can tell he's the kind of person, and I'd love to have him on the show in the future. We've asked him once and we didn't get a response, but hopefully we will get him soon. We certainly had a lot of other more famous people than him, but he seems to dig deeper. You know, like when I can tell he's the kind of person who, when he thinks of something, he thinks deeper and then he thinks a layer deeper than that and peels that onion back. And that's what makes him so interesting to listen to. But tell us about that house down the street. I don't know what you're going to say. You wanted to talk about that.
To your point, it is funny because, you know, your brain is a muscle, and if you don't use it, it's going to atrophy and, you know, wither. And the more you flex it, the more, you know, you'll be able to use it to your advantage. And we kind of laugh, my wife and I, because, you know, it had been a while that we started going to this gym more regularly. And, you know, when you're trying to figure out the weights to do exactly how much, you know, lifting you need to do, it's funny how this grade school math, you go, oh, gosh, I'm so bad. It's just because I haven't had to exercise that part of my brain in a while. And so we had to just sort of laugh at it. But yeah, as far as this house, you know, so we live in this little historic community, and I want to read a house description for you. This is about, you know, probably 10 doors down from our house. And, I want you to both guess how much it's for rent. And then, and I think you might get a kick out of this. So it's a 4-bedroom, 3-bath, Queen Anne's Victorian style house. It's 2,200 square feet and it's for lease, and it's cute inside, you know, original Doug Fir, you know, flooring and, you know, and so I'm just curious, what do you think a 4-bedroom, 3-bath house would rent for? You might be pretty good at this.
In your neighborhood?
In our neighborhood.
Well, I don't know, but I wish you would tell me one number because I can guess the other. And interestingly, just a little quick sideline before we wrap this one up. Yesterday, I was in an Uber car and the Uber driver was from Bangladesh. And he told me that he had an apartment in Bangladesh that he purchased in 1998, or maybe it was 97. Yeah, 97, 20 years ago. And he paid $100,000 for it. And he said it had skyrocketed. I think the city's called Dhaka, I think is the name. Forgive me if I'm wrong on that. But I had read that both Bangladesh and Sri Lanka had two really expensive real estate cities. So he said, and we were talking all about real estate, and he didn't know I was in real estate, by the way. We were just talking about New York real estate, and somehow it got onto this. He said today it's worth $875,000.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, can you believe that? 20 years later. And so the market there has skyrocketed. And I said, how much do you rent that for? And he said, well, I rent it for $1,000 a month. And I thought, oh my God, terrible. And he thought he was doing great, of course. And he said, but the tenant pays for the maintenance fees, which are like $200 or $300 per month. So $1,200, $1,300 per month, really, right? Whatever that means. But then he said he was looking at a place to buy because he rents in New York City. And I was telling him that, or not New York City specifically, but Long Island. Okay. And he said, he's looking for a place to buy, and he's looking at a place, but the down payment is pretty steep. And I said, how much is the place you're looking at to buy? And, you know, I said, how much is the house you're living in now? How much is it worth? And I can't remember which number. I think we were talking about the house he lives in now. And he said it was worth $430,000. And I said, oh, well, I'm guessing you can rent that place for $2,500. And he said, exactly. How do you know that? And I said, because no matter where you go on planet Earth, unless it's government controlled in terms of the marketplace, the ratios are always the same. Okay. Now on his Bangladesh apartment, he should be getting $8,750 per month at 1% rent to value ratio or RV ratio, which I told him, and he thought that's impossible. And I said, yeah, I know. That's why you should sell it and buy 8 houses and rent them for $1,000 a month each. You'll have 8,000.
Which yeah. Boy, isn't that's getting hard.
Well,
to
it
do
is.
Now,
yeah.
Even the 1%, which is kind of surprising. I would have thought that that was a metric that would be easy to obtain, but it's getting hard.
No, the market's appreciated. It's pretty hard to get 1%, but you know, still have it be the target. Get as close to it as you can with decent quality properties. Of course, if you go to crap properties where it's going to be really hard to collect the rent, you can get 1% all day long, even better. But well, you can get it on the pro forma, but can you get it in real life? That's the question. Okay, so you got to give me one of the numbers on the house, either what the rent is or the value.
Okay, before I tease this out totally, I want to read you this description because I think it'll just bring it more into light. So you're going to find this funny. Landmark 1905 three-story Queen Anne Victorian with 4 bedrooms, 2.5 baths is rich with history and was the original set for the movie Big Mama's House. So this is a house that obviously is nice, but you know, I think Big Mama's House was with Martin Lawrence, and it was like, you know, Martin Lawrence dressing up in a fat suit and being like this kind of, you know, grandma with a spoon wanting to hit you or something. I don't remember.
I didn't see it, so I don't know.
What I thought was funny is like, here's a house that's representative of someone who's, you know, middle class, maybe even slightly, you know, lower middle class. And this is the house that they picked. Like, you know, how many times have you seen a commercial where someone's going to the front door with an apple pie? And you look at the house and you go, yeah, that's supposed to be the middle income, you know, middle class type house going next door asking if they have sugar. And today, those houses are worth millions of dollars. And I just thought, boy, that's funny that stuff is like so inaccessible now to people who are even upper middle class, you know. And so this house is, like they said, a 4-bedroom, 2.5 bath. They're asking $7,500 a month for.
Wow.
And in fact, I thought that was so insane.
I'm actually shocked. They're never going to get that, are they? I mean, that's no way.
You know what?
How much is the house worth? Right.
You know, it's hard because the Zestimate, a house like this was selling for about, has gone up, I've seen about 1.2, 1.3.
Oh, which is, they're not going to get $7,500.
I mean, and $7,500 is what a house in Laguna Beach was selling for, or was renting for, $7,500. Maybe even slightly cheaper than that, like a nice house in Laguna Beach was at this rate. But I'll tell you what, Jason, I've looked at other rentals, and literally 3-4 doors down, a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, $4,000. A small 3-bedroom, 2-bath, $4,000. It's just nuts. So...
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. Well, interesting stuff for sure. So, yeah, the point is having these smaller, less expensive houses diversified into many markets with good RV ratios, that's the way to go. I mean, it's just totally the way to go. So, yeah. What's your next game plan with your real estate portfolio, Drew?
You know, I'm not sure. I think I would like to go into another market and, you know, or possibly, I am looking in northern Indianapolis, like Fisher, Carmel, or Noblesville. I'm sort of looking into those areas right now because there's a lot of investment going on there. Some big companies are moving into that area. And, you know, you can get a nice new build for, you know, $225,000 and rent it out for maybe, you know, $1,800 to $2,000 a month. And I think you get a better quality tenant. You know, you don't have, instead of having one renter that's renting a place for $1,000 a month and you have, you know, a utility bills and property taxes, you know, I don't want two of everything. If I can, I'd like to find a place where, you know, it's maybe a little bit more expensive, but you have a higher quality tenant. You have more rent. You don't have, you have less complexity. You know, you don't have two dishwashers. So I'm kind of looking in that area, but since I own so many in Indianapolis right now, I'm not sure. I might tease it out and think about somewhere else.
Interesting stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the U.S. and where it's going and kind of contrast with some of the rest of the world a little bit. And then let's talk about some technologies that are going to really impact real estate investing and the world in general. As you all know, listeners, I think it's an amazing time to be alive. But interestingly, I must have a Dr. and Jekyll, you know, personality, or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality, because in some ways, I'm like this super optimist, right? But in other ways, you know, I listen to a lot of negative stuff, and I don't know, maybe that's the, you know, I just try to balance myself out. I am a Libra after all, the sign of the scales. So maybe that's the reason, but you just got to hear both sides of the equation. And remember that everything is relative. The question to always ask ourselves, I think, is compared to what? I think that's the magic question of life in every category, compared to what, with a question mark. And as bad as things are around the world, as bad as things are in the U.S., as mired in bureaucracy and political correctness as we are in the U.S., and you know, it's better than Europe, I'll tell you that. I just got back from Europe, and what a mess. I mean, so many levels in so many ways. I don't know. I mean, Drew, any thoughts on that? I want to play a little clip from Mark Stein here.
Well, you know, it is funny. I think my first time traveling outside the U.S. in a major way, like I went to Canada and Mexico, but I think my first trip outside the U.S. Was to the Caribbean. And I think when we traveled for a month together, and so it was interesting doing that trip with a group of friends and getting to...
That's when you and I traveled together with a couple of other friends. This was like 7 years ago, I think. We bought the JetBlue All-You-Can-Jet Pass and traveled around for a month everywhere JetBlue flew. Yeah, that was pretty... I wish they'd bring that program back.
Yeah,
that was
I think they stopped it because of us.
they were losing money, yeah.
But, you know, it was funny when we went and traveled over there and getting a chance to see the contrast. And I remember... doing that trip, I think we went to St. Martin and Anguilla, and then came back to, you know, the boring Orlando Winter Park, and going into the Walmart with those like blinding halogen lights and just seeing all the abundance, just how much it hits you in the face versus going to, you know, what basically is a third world country, you know, a pig with lipstick on, and seeing that contrast. So yeah, it is funny how much abundance we have here when you say compared to what.
Yeah, compared to what exactly. And I tell you, this morning I woke up at about 5:30 a.m. and I went out. I did a bunch of errands really quickly. I stopped at Lowe's hardware store and I just could not believe the abundance, the selection. Then I went to Trader Joe's and I couldn't believe the abundance, the selection. And Trader Joe's is a small grocery store. And I'll never forget that time that I got back from my first trip to Latvia. Now, I went to Riga, Latvia for my third time on this last trip. My country count still stands at 81 countries. I did not visit any new countries this time. I just repeated. And, you know, when they built this new Albertsons grocery store in Irvine, California, when I lived there in Quail Hill in Irvine, California. And I know a lot of listeners in Irvine, so they're going to be hearing this and saying, yeah. And I walked into that Albertsons and I was overwhelmed with the abundance of selection and how cheap the prices were and how it's just incredible, like how as Americans, we do not appreciate this enough. We've got to just constantly appreciate this standard of living. And I'm not saying everything's about money. It's certainly not, but that's part of it. Okay. There's no question about it. It means something. And that's really true. But on the negative side, let's just listen to a little clip from Mark Stein's book called After America, Get Ready for Armageddon. And it's interesting, Drew, because I played the Harry Dent interview from a year ago on the last episode of this show, and you did not hear that yet. But tell us a little bit about your thoughts on your last Harry Dent book that you finished.
Well, I don't know. In the interview, did he call two of the next 10 crashes or something?
Yeah, he made a lot of doom and gloom predictions. And, you know, I don't know what this is about these guys, but in general, I think the doom and gloom thing just sells better. You know, there's an old saying in the newspaper business, if it bleeds, it leads.
Well, I think he believes what he's saying. And for a while, I believed what he was saying, too. And I think what should happen on paper and what happens in reality are different things. You know, stuff takes longer to happen. Stuff happens quicker than it should, you know? So kind of how it manifests itself, I think sometimes, even though maybe he's right in philosophy, you know, it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah, Harry Dent's got a lot of predictions that are just all over the board, and I don't know what to think about them, but we'll see. But let's listen to Mark Stein for a minute. Okay. I think you're going to have some good, interesting thoughts on this, and I think our listeners will be fascinated. Pardon the audio quality. I'm literally just playing this from my iPhone speaker. So, here we go. This will be about a 7-minute clip, but we'll probably interrupt it for some commentary. So let's listen into Mark Stein from his book, After America.
Damn. Well, okay. So where is it? Crescent Moon. Half a century ago, the future felt different. Take 1969, quite a year in the aerospace biz. In one 12-month period, we saw the test flight of the Boeing 747, the maiden voyage of the Concorde, the RAF's deployment of the Harrier jump jet, and Neil Armstrong's giant step for mankind. Buzz Aldrin packed a portable tape player with him on Apollo 11, and so Sinatra's ring-a-ding-ding recording of Fly Me to the Moon became the first human music to be flown to the moon and played there. Had any other nation beaten NASA to it, they'd have marked the occasion with the Ode to Joy or Also Sprague Zarathustra, something grand and formal. But there's something marvelously American about the first human being to place his feet on the surface of a heavenly sphere, standing there with a cassette machine blasting out Frank and the Count Basie Band in a swinging Quincy Jones arrangement. The insouciant swagger of the American century breaking the bounds of the planet. In 1961, before the eyes of the world, President Kennedy had set American ingenuity a very specific challenge and put a clock on it. This nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. That's it. No wiggle room. A monkey on the moon wouldn't count, nor an unmanned drone, nor a dune buggy that can't take off again but transmits grainy footage back to Houston as it rusts up in the crater it came to rest in. The only way to win the bet is with a real, live, actual American standing on the surface of the moon, planting the stars and stripes. Even as it happened, the White House was so cautious that William Safire wrote President Nixon a speech to be delivered in the event of disaster. Fate has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace. Yet America did it. Fly me to the moon, let me sing forevermore. What comes after American yearning and achievement? Democratization. Everybody gets to go to the moon. That all but forgotten Jimmy Webb song from 1969 catches the spirit of the age. Isn't it a miracle that we're the generation that will touch that shiny bauble with our own two hands? Whatever happened to that? 4 decades later, Bruce Charlton, professor of theoretical medicine at the University of Buckingham in England, wrote that landing of men on the moon and bringing them back alive was the supreme achievement of human capability, the most difficult problem ever solved by humans. That's a good way to look at it. The political class presented the boffins with a highly difficult and specific problem, and they solved it in 8 years. Charlton continued, 40 years ago we could do it, repeatedly, but since then we have not been to the moon, and I suggest the real reason we have not been to the moon since 1972 is that we cannot any longer do it. Humans have lost the capability. Of course, the standard line is that humans stopped going to the moon only because we no longer wanted to go to the moon, or could not afford to, or something. But I'm suggesting that all this is BS. I suspect that human capability reached its peak or plateau around 1965-75, at the time of the Apollo moon landings, and has been declining ever since. Can that be true? Charlton is a controversialist gadfly in British academe. But comparing 1950 to the early 21st century, our time traveler from 1890 might well agree with him. And if you think about it, isn't it kind of hard even to imagine America pulling off a moon mission now? The countdown, the takeoff, a camera transmitting real-time footage of a young American standing in a dusty crater beyond our planet, blasting out from his iPod Lady Gaga and the Black Eyed Peas, or whatever the 21st century version of Sinatra and the Basie Band is. It half lingers in collective consciousness as a memory of faded grandeur, the way a 19th century date farmer in Nazaria might be dimly aware that the great ziggurat of Ur used to be around here someplace. So what happened? According to Professor Charlton, In the 1970s, the human spirit began to be overwhelmed by bureaucracy. The old can-do spirit? Oh, you can try to do it, but they'll toss every obstacle in your path. Go on, give it a go. Invent a new medical device, start a company. Go to the airport to fly to DC and file a patent. Everything's longer, slower, more soul-crushing. And the decline in human capability will only worsen in the years ahead.
This is one of the comments I want to make. I want to just stop that for a moment, about the European experience. And, you know, Drew, I mean, you've been to Europe. I've been many times. I was born there. It's my ancestral homeland. It's just shocking that, you know, it's like what the U.S. is becoming if we don't fix this. Hopefully the Trump administration will fix it. Who it remains to be seen. I don't know. Trump's certainly got his share of problems and issues. You know, no one would deny that. Not even a supporter of him. But it's like there, it's every obstacle is thrown in your path. You just try to do a simple thing. And the European response that you hear all too often is, well, that's not the procedure. It's not our policy. You know, at least in the States, you'll have some creative thinking. Someone will go out of their way to try and make the customer happy. But it's just so, it's like bureaucracy is just ingrained in the culture. And everybody seems to look at the government as like their uncle that's protecting them instead of the Reagan era, you know, is the, like the most dangerous words are, I'm from the government. I'm here to help, right? You know, I look at the government mostly as an imposition, as something that gets in the way. And it's, you know, that's just, you know, when you're in business and you live in the real world and you're not some professor living in some college womb or some student that just got out of that college womb, when you live in the real world, you find that to be true. Yes, we need government. It provides some things that we need. You know, I don't like anarchy, but it just gets in the way. It just stifles innovation. Mark Stein was talking about how in the old days, all of these great new medical cures were invented. And now with the FDA, it's just become this bureaucracy that's corrupted by money and lobbyists and special interests, just like everything else.
And yeah, but Jason, don't you feel so much safer?
Oh, no, I don't feel safer. Yeah.
you know, it's funny. I was having a conversation with someone about, you know, how the European mindset is, you know, buying your groceries that you need that day. And like how, you know, in America, we just have this gluttony and how we just have so much excess and like how the Europeans do it so much differently. They, you know, have 5 pieces of clothing that they wear over and over again and sort of this minimalist lifestyle.
That's why they smell bad on the subways.
Some of that's to be admired. But I was telling the person, I said, don't you realize that they're doing that of necessity?
Yeah.
They can't, they don't have that abundance. They don't have that option. So they're doing with what they can. So even though I think we can get a little out of hand, I just thought that was kind of amusing.
Look, the U.S., you can say Americans are gluttonous and you'd be right. Okay. That's not untrue. Unfortunately, it's a sad thing about the U.S., but at least I'd rather have the ability to be a glutton and have to exercise my own self-control of not becoming an out-of-control materialist or pack rat or collector or out-of-control consumer or out-of-control overeater, okay, than the other way around, where I could be, you know, the person who is forced into, you know, minimalism, you know, like, yeah, let's at least have the choice. Let's have our economy and our culture and our legal system give us the freedom of that choice. Now, we may well become our own worst enemy and not be able to control ourselves, right? The kid in the candy store metaphor. But, you know, that's what freedom's all about. With freedom comes responsibility, and that responsibility is self-control. So let's just finish up this Mark Stein thing, and then we'll go on.
It's not just excess bureaucracy, but insufficient cash. Yes, we can, drone the dopey Obamatrons of 2008. No, we can't, says Charlton. Not if you mean land on the moon, swiftly win wars against weak opposition and then control the defeated nation, secure national borders, discover breakthrough medical treatments, prevent crime, design and build to a tight deadline, educate people so they are ready to work before the age of 22. Houston, we have a much bigger problem. To be sure, there's still something called NASA, and it still stands for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. But there's not a lot of either aeronautics or space in the inbox of the agency's head honcho. A few days after Charlton penned his elegy for human capability, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden appeared on Al Jazeera and explained the brief he'd been given by President Obama. One was he wanted me to help re-inspire children to want to get into science and math. He wanted me to expand our international relationships. And third, and perhaps foremost, he wanted me to find a way to reach out to the Muslim world and engage much more with dominantly Muslim nations to help them feel good about their historic contribution to science and math and engineering. Islam, the final frontier. To boldly go where no diversity outreach consultant has gone before. What's foremost for NASA is to make Muslims feel good about their contributions to science. Why, as recently as the early 9th century, Muhammad al-Khwarizmi invented the first universal horary quadrant. Things have been a little quiet since then, or at least since Taqi al-Din's observatory in Istanbul was razed to the ground by the Sultan's Janissaries in 1580. If you hear a Muslim declaring we have liftoff, it's likely to be a triumphant ad lib after lighting up his crotch. As far as I recall, the most recent Islamic contribution to the subject of space exploration came from Britain's most prominent imam, Abu Hamza, who in 2003 declared that the fate of the space shuttle Columbia was God's punishment because it carried Americans, an Israeli, and a Hindu, a trinity of evil against Islam.
Can you believe
this? It's easy to laugh at the likes of Abu Hamza, although not as easy as it should be, not in Europe and Canada, where the state is eager to haul you into court for Islamophobia. But the laugh's on us. NASA is the government agency whose acronym was known around the planet to every child who looked up at the stars and wondered what technological marvels the space age would have produced by the time he was out of short pants. Now the starry-eyed moppets are graying boomers. The agency that symbolized man's reach for the skies has transformed itself into a self-esteem boosterism operation. Is there an accompanying book? Muslims are from Mars, infidels are from Venus? There's your American decline right there. From out of this world to out of our minds, an increasingly unmanned flight from real, historic, technological accomplishment to unreal, ahistorical, therapeutic, touchy-feely multiculti. So we can't go to the moon. And by the time you factor in getting to the airport to do the shoeless shuffle and the enhanced pat-down, flying to London takes longer than it did in 1960. If they were trying to build the Transcontinental Railroad now, they'd be spending the first 3 decades on the environmental impact study and hammering in the golden spike to celebrate the point at which the Feasibility Commission's expansion up from the 5th floor met the Zoning Board's expansion down from the 12th floor. Google and Apple and the other latter-day American success stories started in somebody's garage, the one place where innovation isn't immediately buried by bureaucracy. Or at least in most states, not until some minor municipal functionary discovers you neglected to apply for a not-sitting-around-on-my-ass-all-day permit. What did Apple and company do in those garages? They invented and refined home computers, an entirely logical response to late 20th century America. When reality seizes up, freedom retreats and retrenches to virtual reality, to the internal. Where once space was the final frontier, now we frolic in the canyons of our mind. We're in the Wilbur and Orville era of the internet right now, but at the Federal Communications Commission and other agencies, they're already designing the TSA uniforms for the enhanced cyber pat-down.
And you know what I'd call those? I'd call them the political correctness thought police at Google, Facebook, and now Airbnb. It's just absolutely scary. This is like the new Nazi book burning, the new Fahrenheit 451, where these huge companies get to decide who rents a house, illegally, by the way, based on total discrimination. Shame on Airbnb. Read about it, folks. It's in the news, okay? And Google and Facebook, literally the morning after we heard about the Trump election, I'd never heard the phrase fake news before in my life. And suddenly fake news was everywhere. That's how Trump got elected, fake news, right? But yet these big news media organizations have been engaged in fake news for at least 3 decades. CNN has been caught red-handed, the Communist News Network, with their fake news propaganda so many times, it's pathetic. This is just pathetic. So yeah, the thought police are here. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really funny that this whole essay is talking about NASA. And, I remember this article that I read not too long ago talking about how the social warriors, the social justice warriors, were really upset with Target because apparently they hadn't come out with a female version of a NASA shirt for little girls. And so they had a boy's shirt, but they didn't have a girl's shirt. And it was funny because Target actually responded linking to the girl's shirt because they had even gone that far of having both a girl's and a boy's shirt. And so we're so consumed with, you know, doing what's politically correct rather than accomplishing anything substantial. You know, and that kind of leads into what Elon Musk is doing with his private SpaceX, because NASA just couldn't get anything done. He went on, you know,
Elon Musk, the world's biggest crony capitalist. Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is that the government loves to give money to Boeing and all these other companies, you know, the industry, the war machine. And, you know, he does tap into that. But, you know, he has called for ending all the subsidies, which I guess is easy to say. But, you know, it's the thing is, the rules are so skewed that you have to play by that game. Otherwise, you'll lose. You know, whether it's
well, and that's okay. So that same standard then should apply to Trump's cabinet. You know, the guy who said he was going to drain the swamp, which arguably he's not draining the swamp. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe he will. You know, the jury's just out. I don't know. I don't know what to make of Trump.
Yeah.
It's just too early. But you know, all the liberals criticize Trump, saying, look at who he's put on his cabinet. You know, all these people from here and there. Well, who's he supposed to put on the cabinet? Like, you know, I mean, how could you not put people that are big execs and people who have power and connections on a presidential cabinet? I mean, who are you supposed to put? You know, the homeless guy down the street? I mean,
yeah,
I don't know.
It does,
you know,
seem a little...
It's like an impossible thing.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, you know, he's going to put people that he knows and has some connection to and have some authority, as he should. I think it is a little weird when he's putting, you know, Trump Jr. and Ivanka on the cabinet, even though
it's all nepotism.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you're taking your staff from your reality TV show and putting it in the White House, I think it's poor form, and obviously they have no experience.
Trump thinks the presidency is a reality show. That's what's scary about Trump.
Yeah, I know.
But I don't know. You know, maybe he's actually a genius, and we just don't know it because he's controlling the news cycle.
Well, according to Trump, he's a genius.
Yeah. Well, yes. If you listen to him, one man PR firm.
Which was sad because he, you know, when he got elected, he was beholden to no one. I mean, he kind of stumbled into winning, in my opinion. And, you know, and then, you know, because they picked a terrible candidate to run against him. And then, you know, he didn't owe anyone anything. And it seems like he had the ability to drain the swamp. But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem like he is, but hopefully, you know, I guess we should give him a little bit more time to try to get something done.
I know. We'll see. But let's talk a little bit about some technology and wrap up with this. You know, as pessimistic as some of the stuff we've talked about today is, and Mark Stein talked about, I do really think it's an amazing time to be alive. I think technology could just rescue us all. Hopefully the government will get out of the way and let it all happen. You know, to some extent, the free market forces are so powerful, they ultimately win. Okay. Even in North Korea and Cuba, the free market wins. You know, even with massive government control, there's always a gray market, a black market, that's underneath the government controlled market that always ultimately, wins eventually, at least. What did you want to talk about that's going on with like self-driving cars and these amazing technologies that I think will change the real estate game significantly? And just to bring that back into focus, you know, I've said before, but the three primary value drivers of real estate have always been what? Location, location, location. And location or geography are less meaningful than they've ever been in human history. I'm not saying they're not still meaningful. I'm just saying they have less meaning than ever before. Through technology, through communications technology, through transportation technology, especially the autonomous vehicle. What did you want to talk about there, Drew?
Well, first, on a pessimistic note, I think it's funny that we're talking about NASA, because in light of that, you know, Peter Thiel had a very funny quote that he made a few years ago talking about how we all wanted flying cars and instead we got 140 characters with, you know, Twitter, and how, you know, there's been a bit of a stagnation in terms of, you know, technology, you know, in terms of transportation. So I think that we're coming at a point now where things are going to change dramatically. And we kind of talked about this in private some, where, you know, I think what's interesting is you see Uber kind of taking over the inefficiencies of the taxi system and sort of trying to dominate in transportation. And you see Airbnb, you know, sort of going after hotels and the you know, the lock that they have on that and kind of offering inefficiencies and people having excess, whether it be in their homes, and putting that to use.
So what you, let me just talk about that for, make a comment on that. So what you see is you see how the sharing economy is taking all of these formerly dormant, unused resources in the world. Okay. And it's putting them to work, which is an amazing, amazing thing. And it's funny because, the last European country I was in was Norway. Okay. Norway becoming a disaster of socialism and immigration, even though Norway's got tons of money in their sovereign wealth fund. I get it, you know, with the natural resources and so forth. But I'm telling you, Scandinavia is not looking good. Okay. You just wait 10, 20 years. You'll see what I mean. Okay. But the amazing thing is when I was leaving the hotel, I was asking the concierge to go to the airport, should I use Uber or what? And she said, Uber's illegal in Norway. And I pulled it up on my phone and I said, no, I got it right here. And I already used it once when I was here. And she's, well, it's illegal. Well, so what? People use it anyway. And who cares if it's illegal? You know, Airbnb is illegal in New York City, but people use it. Okay. You cannot stop the power of a great idea. And that's what the free market is. That's what capitalism is. The most natural and most successful, quote unquote, religion ever in human history is capitalism. And everybody wants it. It's totally natural. And you can't stop it no matter what you do. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I completely agree. I think what's funny is that, you know, when you look at Uber and transportation and Airbnb with real estate, how it has changed the landscape in terms of how people approach real estate. You know, a lot of these beach communities have had to just outlaw it because it's changed the dynamic so much there. My wife and I, we went and walked down on the peninsula in Newport Beach, and it's just every other house on that boardwalk is just, you know, a beach rental. And so now when you have what would be a, you know, a place that someone would live full time, and you're competing against someone renting it with four families for a, you know, for a weekend, the prices just have changed so dramatically that it has, you know, and think about all the congestion and just issues. So, you know, I know a lot of people have been trying to stop it, because it does have unintended consequences. But, you know, again, yeah, you're right. When you have a good idea and, you know, most people wouldn't be able to rent a place right by the beach and now you can, you know, there's kind of a give and take as far as, you know, whether it's good or not. But obviously it's the government wants to stop it because, you know, the hotel industry is probably petitioning them to, you know, get on it so they don't take away from their monopoly. But,
yeah, well, you know, they've got their lobbyists for sure.
Yeah.
But and so do the taxi drivers.
But, I, you know, I think just kind of I've been looking at kind of these trends in and I think when you say the shared economy, I think there's a more broader issue here, which like is about how people are circumventing all this congestion in the in government rules, like whether it be, you know, for example, just solar power, you know, having to be tied to a grid. And now, you know, if you could put solar on your house and that becomes affordable enough in the foreseeable future, or if you have an electric car that you don't have to go to the gas station and you can power off your, you know, roof panels. And I don't know if it will quite give you enough power. And I know there's a lot of government tied up in that, but, you know, I think it's interesting that all these technologies are basically trying to work around the inefficiencies that the government has put there. And I think that's why we've had such a reaction to, you know, to Bitcoin, because the government, what they're doing with money has, you know, most people are rejecting. Now, I think that's a bubble, but maybe I'm getting off topic, but
The whole cryptocurrency and alternative currency thing, as I've said before, I would love nothing more than to be wrong about this. I just don't think the governments and central banks around the world are going to let it happen. I mean, they're going to let it play out a little bit, but somehow they're going to find a way to control the money supply. They must do that. It is imperative to their mission. Yeah. That is where the governments and central banks around the planet gain most of their power, through the control of the money supply. That is the one last very reliable bastion that, you know, they can control. And so I don't have a lot of faith in alternative currencies that aren't controlled by the government. Now, people confuse the Bitcoin thing, and I know we've got to wrap up, Drew, because you got to go, but they confuse the concept of the blockchain, which is part of the technology on which Bitcoin, for example, is built. And they confuse that with Bitcoin itself. Okay, right. Those are different things. They have to be separated.
Yeah, yeah.
Blockchain is great. And you know, any government or the United Nations or whatever, or any central bank, can create a digital currency that uses blockchain technology, and that would be awesome for them, but they will still control and manipulate it at some level. And that's how they can control the literally the wealth of nations, to borrow a cliche from Adam Smith. Not a cliche, but a wonderful, awesome philosophy. You know, you should read The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. It's incredible. The Invisible Hand. But government needs to control that. They're not going to give that up. Okay. They are not. Mark my words, they will never give that up.
Okay? No, some government will outlaw it because, you know, there will be some news story, whether it be contrived or real, where, you know, somebody's trying to launder money, and this is, the terrorists are using this, so we're going to make it illegal. And if you do any transaction,
the terrorists and the prostitutes and the drug dealers and the international arms dealers, that's all it's going to be. And they're, you know, and then there's going to be some crash and some Bitcoin wallet company, you know, it's already happened a few times, and, you know, China's really come down on Bitcoin. Folks, do not place your bets against, you know, the old saying, never bet against the Fed.
Yeah.
And with my philosophy of investing, you're betting with the Fed. You're taking the two most powerful entities on earth, governments and central banks, and you are aligning your interests with them. And that is the way to go, if you ask me.
Yeah, I watched something on Vice. They have some great stuff, even though they have an agenda. Where they were talking about you know, how drug dealers now, they're doing they don't deal in U.S. dollars anymore. They deal in gold because it's completely anonymous. You can't track it, and they basically will just, and it's, you know, valuable and highly portable. So it is funny how the original money is sort of being preferred now, and I don't know how that will interplay with gold. I know some people have talked about cryptocurrencies backed by gold, but that I just don't think it ever going to work. I'm not buying it.
No way. Well, this has been an interesting talk. We've been all over the board. Drew, we got to wrap it up, especially for you, because you need to go. But anything else you want to say to our listeners?
Well, I wanted to tease out that last point that I think we were talking about, where we were talking about self-driving cars, because I think that is going to be the next big thing, if we have time to talk about it. That's going to be the next big thing. And I think I talked to you about how that will change the real estate landscape dramatically. You know, I think now it's quite amazing how, you know, I was in Denver for the week and didn't know the area too well. I got on my phone, I went on Uber Eats, and I delivered something to the place I was staying where I didn't have a rental car. Then, you know, the friend I was staying with did this $5 subscription thing where every ride that you take with Uber is $5 and you can just go anywhere within the town. So, you know, we're spending $20 a day on, you know, just driving around, going to different places, walking around the city, and then Ubering back. And, you know, just how going through all the, you know, insurance and paying the city taxes for renting a car and doing all this sort of stuff just now is sort of getting usurped. And, I think that what's going to happen in the future is people are just not going to, you know, retired couples and even maybe young people are going to create a nomadic lifestyle where it's going to be too expensive or predatory for them to be in one place. So what they'll do instead is just have a vehicle or, you know, like let's say a self-driving motorhome where they will be able to commute all around and go from place to place and have it drive at night. And, you know, their services can be both mobile and their, you know, lifestyle can be enriched because they're not going to be in the same place at the same time. And if they can have a P.O. box in, you know, in Las Vegas and have that be their primary residency.
Well, better yet, have it be in Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
That's even better. But the thing is, see, all of this concept of taxation is about nexus, tax nexus, right? And the tax nexus is always based on geography. And now that geography is becoming difficult. You know, in the old days, if you were a business owner, you probably owned a physical business, which was either a store or a factory or something where it was definitely clearly defined as to where that was located and what jurisdiction got the privilege of oppressing, taxing you. Now that's become very fuzzy. You know, I think about these immigration laws, and I've often thought, well, what if I want to go live in another country for a while just to have an interesting new experience, right? Say I want to move to Europe, right? Maybe even Eastern Europe, the land of the supermodels. The problem is I can't put up with a stupid bureaucracy and the small thinking European mindset, right? But that's what drives me nuts, and that's why I'm glad to be home. But if I did that, you know, the immigration laws that would let me potentially move to another country would say, you know, look, what they don't want you to do is they don't want you to go take someone's job. They don't want you to go take the job of a native, of a citizen that lives there. But see, I wouldn't have to do that. I wouldn't take anybody's job because I just work from my laptop in an internet connection, okay? And, you know, do my podcasting. We've got this global audience, listeners in 164 countries, clients all over the world that buy properties, admittedly all in the U.S., but in multiple states and jurisdictions. And so, you know, it's just a totally new world, and people can be much more nomadic than they've ever been. So, like my quote, geography is less meaningful than it's ever been in human history.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, so I'll be curious to see how it plays out, because, you know, the government is going to keep trying to make more rules to pigeonhole people. And, you know, it's funny how they always are trying to incentivize certain things rather than give people freedom. So it may be whether it's, you know, telling people that we're going to give you a tax deduction if you have more kids, to saying if you buy a house and you have a bunch of debt, we're going to give you, you know, this reprieve or this benefit or incentive. And so, you know, when people buck that system and, you know, technology becomes your friend to basically get around those, you know, incentives, it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, where the incentive is maybe up front, but I don't know how it'll play out as far as in the long run.
I would say if someone is a government bureaucrat, they are in a high insecurity position nowadays. The power has swung away from governments, and it has swung toward the people, thankfully. That's the way it should be. And it is much harder for the government to figure out how to tax people nowadays. You know, they're trying to keep up with it, but the law and the government are always behind the trend. So we'll see how that unfolds, and we'll talk about it more on the show. But needless to say, you know, owning real estate in diverse jurisdictions is going to be helpful to you in this new world. So following my 10 commandments of successful investing, owning real estate that is not in the expensive markets, because transportation is getting much better and easier, and communication is much better and easier. There's a new app, forgive me, I was listening to in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday when I was coming back from the airport last night, that basically, you know, some of the new social media stuff that's taking place in communications is basically where it's like this living room, very lightweight communication. And if you look at Amazon's new, it's not the Echo, but it's the new one with video, where people can basically just drop in. It's not as formal as making a phone call or sending an email or a text message or even a Voxer. Voxer is my favorite way to communicate, where they can just kind of drop in and open a video chat. Like they're in the same room with you is improving communication dramatically. So there's a lot of stuff that's changing things and making geography so much less meaningful. So if you're buying, the point here is, if you're buying the typical type of properties that we sell through our network, these suburban type properties in these lower price markets, I think the value of those is going to be pushed higher, and
Absolutely.
The value of expensive type properties is going to be pushed lower, right? Yeah,
I think that that's interesting. I think that the top plot properties are going to plateau because they've gone up so much, and that will push downward pressure on the lower properties, the properties that are more the B, you know, B type properties.
Second tier properties, second tier cities.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you think about it, in the last decade, you know, we were talking about, my wife went to a baby shower in Emerald Bay, which is probably like the most expensive real estate in Orange County. And, so, you know, she was looking at this beautiful house. It was huge, and
it's only $28 million.
We went and looked it up, and it was, you know, $8 million, and
that's cheap. What the
Zillow was, and I said it's probably worth more than this, but it's probably worth $10 million, and they bought the property in 2000 for $1 million, and it's funny because, you know, it's gone up 10 times, so that can't happen again. It can't go. It's not going to go up another 10 times.
Unsustainable.
So I think it's more going to flatten, and you know, that's going to put downward pressure on you know, people. What used to be a $1 million house, now you know, that's going to be more in the B property zone, as far as you know, some more suburban. I think that's where the action is. So
it's more the necessity type housing. That's where the action is, no question about it. And, you know, being in New York City yesterday, I just thought, what is the huge attraction about living here? You know, I was there a month ago on my way to Europe. I spent a day there on the way back. And, you know, it's just, everything is just high on the hassle factor, if you ask me. I don't get it. I want to get it. You know, I thought maybe I'll go live in New York City this fall. I'm still kind of thinking about that because I'm, you know, very mobile, and I really want to experience some other places. I was stuck in Southern California vast majority of my life, so I'm kind of want to do that. But it's just very high on the hassle factor. Of course, it's super expensive. Everything is a fortune. And so I just think that the power is moving away from places like that to the second tier and even third tier type places that just make a lot more sense. Life is easier. You can still communicate and have all the benefits of those places. You know, like one of the things New York City people say to me all the time is, you know, you can get food from any type of restaurant 24 hours a day. Well, you can do that with Uber Eats now too, folks. You know, it's just, it's all changing.
When you talk about the hassle factor, I have to laugh because my metric for those sort of things is, how big of a hassle is it to get a case of water in your house? And that's kind of my metric for how easy somewhere a place is. So maybe you're in rural, you know, Montana, and you have to drive, you know, an hour to the grocery store to buy something and drive it back. Or, you know, you're in New York City and you have to go down 5 flights of stairs and you don't have an elevator. And, you know, then you have to walk to the market.
Don't forget, in New York City, and if you have a doorman in your building, you've got to tip him a fortune, because he will not give you your packages if you do not tip your unionized, incredibly lazy, greedy doorman in New York City. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I heard that, like, if you don't get him a gift for, you know, $5,000 or something for Christmas, they'll
not
like, 5, you know,
000, but,
not.
Yeah.
Or it's just something ridiculous. I don't know.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
totally. Yeah.
But yeah,
interesting stuff. Drew, we got to wrap it up. I know you've got to go to lunch, and our listeners have been listening a long time, so let's let them go. But we'll have you back on a future episode. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Happy investing. Be sure you go to HartmanEducation.com/contest and get your last chance in to enter the Amazon Echo. Amazing new technology. Love that. Also go to JasonHartman.com and get in on the early bird pricing for our upcoming Meet the Masters of Income Property event in Southern California, San Diego, in January. A lot of you, we've sold a zillion tickets for Meet the Masters already. So thank you for buying those and getting in on the early bird special. Anybody who hasn't done it yet, jasonhartman.com, click on the events section and get your tickets for that. And Drew, thanks again for joining me. Happy investing, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if
If you require specific legal or tax advice, or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.